Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
Jerk. You absolute asshole.
I always try to startle Monica with my little intro, and it works every time.
It's because I'm sitting a literal foot to your right. Jesus Christ.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Shot for Shot. I am your very, very loud host, Alex Oakley.
And I'm your more moderately, moderate host, Monica Beard.
We just need to get a host who whispers, and then we've got the triumvirate.
Fucking trifecta. I don't think we could, I think if we had one more person involved in this, it would just...
These would take 3 hours.
We would just start having a regular conversation, I feel like.
And then the audience would feel left out, then we'd go off track the whole time.
It's already pretty much a regular conversation.
Oh, goodness. Yeah.
This is verbatim all, like, what we talk about.
This is how we sound normally.
Anyway.
Welcome.
It is a rainy, rainy, cold Wednesday.
Oh, God, it's so frigid.
Here in Georgia. It's been pretty shitty all week.
You're right.
But we get to hang out together today, and we get to do a... super fun episode today. We're doing something a little different, and we will speak more to that right before we start. But first of all, we have some very sad, I guess it's not news. I'm sure everyone
it's
knows
news
by
you've
now.
Already heard, but
it's very sad.
As of the release date of this podcast, a week ago, on the 12th of November, Stan Lee passed away. Stan Lee, known as the father of comics. Pretty much rightfully so. I mean,
it was an ouchie. It was like Carrie Fisher.
Carrie Fisher, passed. David Bowie, you know, everybody.
It's really rough.
2018's been a rocker and a shocker.
Yeah, but I mean, I feel like I owe a lot to this guy because, I mean, I don't know about you, but for me, Iron Man was actually the movie that got me into movies and into superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and from that point on, when I saw that movie, I just like, I dove into this whole universe, and to this day, you know, I still love comics and movies. Mm-hmm. So,
it was the X-Men for me.
This is a tough one.
X-Men brought me in on it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Oh, man. I don't know.
It's a hard loss, but he's leaving behind such an amazing legacy.
In all honesty, is there even a reason to go see Marvel movies anymore? If he's not going to have a cameo?
If he's not going to be there?
They could pull a Rogue One.
Do not. I thought of it the second I saw a glint in your eye as you thought of that. Don't even suggest it.
I mean,
I do not want gooey CGI Stanley on.
No, I don't. I definitely don't either. I definitely don't either.
Let him rest.
Yeah,
he deserves. What was your favorite Stanley cameo?
Oh,
I'm sorry. I just popped that on you.
No. It's fine.
It's
fine.
It's a good question.
Probably. Weirdly enough, I think my favorite Stanley cameo was actually Big Hero 6.
What was he in that?
He was, okay, remember?
No, I do remember.
The rich kid who just wore the monster suit. And, he talks about his absent parents, and you see a photo, and his dad is clearly Stan Lee. And then if you watch to the end credit scene, that's when the actual cameo is, and he finds out that his dad is actually a superhero, and they have the same philosophy on wearing underwear 4 times.
That's cute.
It was that. That's a really good one.
I remember that now. My favorite is from The Amazing Spider-Man, the first one with Andrew Garfield.
Mm.
And it's when he's fighting the lizard and Stan Lee plays the librarian. He's like putting away books. Mm-hmm. He has these huge like muffler, like earmuffs on. And so the fight happening right behind him is completely silent.
That's a good
Spider-Man
one.
Spider-Man catches a table before it hits him. That's my favorite.
The Thor one, OG Thor is good, where he's trying to rip the hammer out of the ground and it rips the back off of his truck.
Oh, yes. And then in the one, I think it was after Age of Ultron, where he said, I have a package for Tony Stank. No, that was at the end of Civil War.
I don't remember.
I think Tony it was
Stank,
Civil War.
Yeah. Or another good one, the OG Iron Man one where Tony Stark mistakes him for Hugh Hefner.
Yes!
He says, hey, how you doing, Hugh? And Stan Lee's just like, huh? But he doesn't say anything in that cameo, which is interesting.
We could do this for the whole entirety of this podcast.
We should do an episode just on Stan Lee cameos. I'm kidding, but we could.
We literally could. We
Oh, man.
Also, we've outed ourselves as really big nerds just now.
So. But all this to say, rest in peace, Stan Lee.
Yeah.
Excelsior.
Excelsior. Moving on. So now we get to talk about the movie we are most excited to see.
Can I go first?
Yes.
Okay. So mine is, I'm super excited for the movie coming out called Green Book. Green Book is about a black pianist, a black musician virtuoso, doing a tour in the South during some pretty contentious historical periods. And he is being driven around by a very gruff white Yankee. And the Yankee is played by Viggo Mortensen, who is most commonly recognized as everybody's favorite Aragorn in The Lord of the Rings. And then the pianist is played by Mahershala Ali, who is, if you've watched Luke Cage, he plays Cottonmouth. He also plays the elder drug dealer in the first act of Moonlight. And he's just, he's fantastic. He's in House of Cards too. He's an actor who just came out of nowhere. Before like House of Cards and Luke Cage, I hadn't seen him in anything, and now all of a sudden he is everywhere, and he deserves to be. He is fantastic. I love his performances. So Viggo Mortensen plus him, I'm excited. It looks like a really good like buddy road trip movie, but with a really interesting and contentious context.
Nice.
What about you?
So mine is called Can You Ever Forgive Me? And it is an adaptation of a memoir by Lee Israel, who made their living profiling different celebrities. They wrote biographies, basically. A ghostwriter, if you will. Yes, that falls out of favor and then turns to the art of deception. And actually, what really grabbed me about this movie, although I have to say I have been and always will be a writing nerd, so a movie about just like a writer, right? Like just that is kind of cool. But what actually really caught my attention with this one was that it's starring Melissa McCarthy as Lee Israel, and this is not Melissa McCarthy's usual bag.
Not the wheelhouse.
No, she's usually pretty much only a comedic actor, and then even within being a comedic actor, she plays pretty much one type of character. So I've heard really good things about her in this, so I'm really excited to see it for myself.
I love it when we get comedic actors and actresses breaking out, because it always makes their performance, when they're good. I'm not passing judgment on this movie one way or another, but early reviews are good. When they're good, I think they're elevated by the fact that we weren't expecting that kind of thing. Like great examples. I mean, The Truman Show is a good one. A more serious take there. What was the one he was in? Jim Carrey was in where Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Another great example. Steve Carell in Foxcatcher. If you ever saw that one, that one was an intense film.
Steve Carell randomly does like really serious movies, and he always looks great. I would argue that I like it when comedic actors get to do more serious roles, because a lot of times people are like, oh, they just act comedy, so they're not as good an actor as people who do primarily dramas. But comedians, like, comic actors have to be, like, you have to be so
comedy's
good.
Harder than drama. Comedy is so much harder than drama.
I as people who act occasionally, as we do, it's infinitely easier to just play straight.
It is so much easier to be sad and depressing and dramatic than it is to be funny, depressing, and dramatic.
Right, you know? So, yeah, I'm really excited for that.
No, yeah, I am really looking forward to seeing it as well. And I am a reported, not a huge fan of Melissa McCarthy.
Yeah.
To each their own. I'm not saying she's not funny. I would never say that, because she is.
I think she's funny. I just wish she would play different types of
different types of funny. Did you see the movie where she was with the puppet? The puppet detective?
No, I did not. That, everything about that whole concept, the trailers, all of it made me very upset.
I hate to even bring it up, but I'm gonna. Did you ever see the Red Band trailer for it? You know, they've always got the regular trailer.
I know.
The Red Band trailer was, oh man. If you guys haven't seen the Red Band trailer for, I don't even remember what it's called. Happy Time Murders, that's it.
I wanted to call it
Sesame Street Murders, but that's copyright. if you haven't seen the Red Band trailer for Happy Time Murders and don't mind feeling like vaguely disgusted by puppets, go ahead.
It's
weirdly graphic for being entirely involving puppets.
Yeah. It's Ugh, I can imagine there were probably some parents that accidentally brought their kids to that thinking it was going to be a Sesame Street. Oh,
God, I hope that not. I hope Muppet that didn't happen, situation. But I feel like it did.
I'm sure it did somewhere.
No, oh, man.
I'm sure people were mad.
Either way, Can You Ever Forgive Me? Looking forward to it. We both me are. Too.
Boom, Green Book. Boom, boom.
Cool.
So this is actually going to be a special episode. We're going to try something we have never done before. So it is a retro review, but it is a retro review and a whole new format where we discuss and compare a remake.
So it's a double retro review.
A double retro.
Double feature.
Double feature. Double creature feature.
I'm into it. Hour. I'm into it. What two movies are we comparing, Monica?
We will be comparing Ocean's 11 from 2001. With Ocean's 11 from 1960.
Way so, back when. Whoosh,
big old gap there.
Mm-hmm.
We recently watched both of these movies within mm-hmm. the same week or so. And yeah, this is another one of those IMDb's modern classics.
Mm-hmm.
So IMDb, I've mentioned it before and I've linked it before. And I will do it again in this episode description. But IMDb has this really cool list of movies that it considers to be modern classics. And it's just like, I looked through it and I think it's a really awesome just like checklist of movies that, you know, if you want to be involved in pop culture, just you should see. So
we should have, I think that
we're going to try to work our way through that list.
We really should. It's a good one.
Yes. So we will be doing Ocean's 11, and I gotta come clean. I'm gonna come clean from the start. I had never seen Ocean's 11, and I feel like people will be like, "Boo!" But yeah,
haven't seen things.
But I loved it. I really, really liked it. I'm excited to talk about it.
I agree. I am more than a little hyped to talk about it because the 2001 Ocean's 11 with George Clooney and all that. I've seen that one more than a few times, and it's. It's killer. It's killer all the way through.
The dialogue in this movie was just so perfect.
Like, it was great.
And that's a really weird thing to hone in on, I feel like, with this film. But I just, the way the characters spoke and interact with each other, I just adored. I loved it so much. They had really awesome this whole cast had really awesome chemistry.
And now that's talking about the 2001 Ocean's 11.
Yes.
We watched the 1960 Ocean's 11 for the first time together. Amazon Prime Video.
Yeah, you can rent it for $3.
Three whole dollars.
$3 if you're looking to find that. In Ocean's 11, you can watch on Hulu.
Yes.
For sure Hulu, maybe Netflix. We watched it on Hulu.
Hulu!
Hulu! So let's just go ahead and get started, and we'll start with the general premise.
All right. So the premise of both of the films, they are both heist films.
Yes.
They are both specifically casino heist films place in the great city of Las Vegas, Nevada, or Nevada. Las Vegas in the middle of the desert.
We've been hanging out in Nevada lately.
Yeah, we really have.
Movie-wise.
Oh, my goodness.
And so basically it is centered around a character, Danny Ocean. And he has these 11 accomplices, and together they rob anywhere from 3 to 5 casinos at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that because in the 2001 version, they rob 3 casinos together. And slight change, not too big a difference, but in the 1960 version, they actually rob 5, which mm-hmm. is, I can imagine they changed that because they were like, let's
5 seems like a bit much.
That's a stretch.
Also, when you get to the actual robbery in the 1960s version, what the robbery looks like seems super unrealistic.
We'll get into that.
But it was kind of an amusing scene.
Yeah, I would say. So, I don't know if you have any ratings for yours, do you?
I do, actually. Yeah.
Let's hear them.
So, the 1960 Ocean's 11, premiering 41 years before the remake, has a 6.6 on IMDb. And then on Rotten Tomatoes, it has a certified fresh 81% audience rating and a 52% critic rating. Now, I'm not sure about this. I might be wrong, but I believe that the audience rating is constantly updated with individuals on Rotten Tomatoes who leave reviews. And so there may be people who left reviews since 1960, but I believe the critic reviews are entirely based on reviews that came out when the movie premiered.
Mm.
So what we may be seeing here with this discrepancy is a bit of almost a nostalgic creep. Because this movie does, for movie buffs and cinemaphiles and people who jive
fans
on,
of the Rat Pack.
Yeah, fans of the Rat Pack, people who jive on that kind of Americana, this movie has a lot of nostalgic value.
Yeah.
So they may end up leaving retroactively positive reviews, which might artificially inflate that score.
That makes sense, because I personally watched it and was like, this is not as good.
That's fair. I agree. It's not quite as good.
But we'll hold off on the opinions. I'll talk about the ratings from Ocean's 11 2001. Oh, by the way, the 1960 version doesn't have a Metascore.
It does not have a Metascore because Metacritic did not exist yet.
Yeah, so a wonderful time in our
humanity. Wonderful time.
Anyway, so Ocean's 11 2001, it gets a 7.8 out of 10 on IMDb, a 74 Metascore, an 82% certified fresh by critics, and an 80% certified fresh by audiences on Rotten Tomatoes. So across the board, everyone was like, great movie. And they were pretty right on that one, I would say.
I agree. The 2001 Ocean's 11 is really, really good.
Yeah, seriously. Really good. So who is the director of your...
So the director of the 1960 Ocean's 11 was a gentleman by the name of Lewis Milestone. Now, Lewis Milestone had a couple of directing credits to his name. The other two that you might recognize are one all the way back from 1930. He directed the original All Is Quiet on the Western Front, which was a really big World War I picture.
Yeah.
And then also... Ocean's 11 was his second to last directed feature. His final directed feature was Mutiny on the Bounty, which is based on a true historical, I believe, British mutiny. And it did well. Mutiny on the Bounty got itself a couple of Oscars in there. Or a couple of big awards, or a couple Oscar nods at least, and a couple of other awards besides. Ocean's 11 didn't get jack shit. I think it got two minor awards nominations, wasn't even considered for an Oscar.
No, which I guess makes sense because... I can see how this move, like how the 1960 version would have been kind of a mediocre film.
Yeah.
Versus the 2001 version for their respective times.
Yeah. I mean, like, I've seen other movies from, you know, the mid 50s, early 60s, and they're better.
Yeah.
There are better films out there. Here, real quick, I'm going to look something up. I want to see what was on the docket for the Academy Awards in 1960. Sure.
In the meantime, I'm going to go ahead and talk about the director for the 2001 film, and that is Steven Soderbergh, a name that you might remember if you listen to our Logan Lucky podcast, because he directed that movie, and he also directed the Ocean's 12 and Ocean's 13 and several other, you know, heist movies. Heist movies are clearly his thing, his genre. I actually think he also headed up the cinematography for this movie as well.
He did.
So it was, you know, this is his bag, and he does it really well.
So yeah,
what are you seeing here, buddy?
Looking back, we've got some stiff competition in the 32nd Academy Award in the year 1960. Best picture was Ben-Hur. Best actor was Charlton Heston for Ben-Hur. Best supporting actor, Hugh Griffith. Ben-Hur. Best director, William Wyler. Ben-Hur. That was the year Ben-Hur came out, which also won Best Cinematography, Best Costume Design, Best Sound Mixing, Film Editing, Production Design.
It swept.
Ben-Hur swept that year. So it came out in a really tough year. Plus, it also came out in the same year as Diary of Anne Frank and Room at the Top, which are both fantastic films. And Pillow Talk too. It had a lot of movies to go up against, and it wasn't the best film in the world. Ocean's 11. It was probably a solidly mediocre film, entirely riding on star power.
Rat Pack star power.
Rat Pack star power.
Which, do you want to speak to that now, or would you like to save it for our characters?
Let's save it for the characters. I would love to get into the nitty-gritty of the Rat Pack.
Sure. We're going to throw this number out there. Note, we don't know for sure if the 1960 number we have is...
It is adjusted for inflation.
It is?
It is adjusted for inflation.
So, we're going to talk about the box office earnings, because we've started doing that. And I don't know. I think it's
interesting.
I like it.
It's an interesting number.
Ocean's 11 in 2001 was a big budget film, and it made that budget back for sure, making about a settling in at about $180 million at the box office.
Wow. So Ocean's 11 didn't do quite that well.
No.
It had a budget of roughly $2 million.
Okay.
And adjusted for inflation made $12 million.
Wow.
Roughly $12,500,000 adjusted for inflation. Now, keep in mind, adjusting for inflation, it's not always as accurate as it could be.
No.
And this is also entirely just the domestic box office. Just the U.S. doesn't include, this number doesn't include Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was released overseas or not. It's 1960, so, you know, where am I going to look that up? Probably Google, but I didn't, so. But there's definitely a discrepancy there. Also, I happen to know that I know that the Ocean's 11 2001 box office was upwards of $60 to $80 million.
On the first weekend?
No. I mean, not box office, budget.
Budget. Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a pretty big budget, which that budget now is like...
Nothing.
Yeah, it's like...
Pennies.
You have bad CG, or no CGI.
Well, they didn't have CGI, I don't think.
No, but I mean, like, now, like... That budget would give you, like, a movie. Yeah, so we are going to... get into the plot. Now, I, myself, have come up with a pretty handy-dandy heist movie formula.
Ooh.
That I think pretty much nails every heist movie ever, pretty much.
So you want to go over this for the first time, live on air, the Monica
Beard
heist movie formula.
Yes, and I think you guys are going to be like, whoa, like every time you see a heist movie after this, think of this, because I'm
think of
right.
Monica.
Because I am correct. All right. So it starts, the first portion is the exposition / the idea. You get the background. You get the character, you know, getting the idea, blah, blah, blah. Then you have the recruitment montage. This is just a series of scenes where you meet all of the other people involved in the heist.
The various members that are needed for
you
the job.
You find out what their niche criminal skill is, and you're off to the races. Next, you start seeing bits and pieces of the plan. This is where there's a bunch of scenes where they're clearly gathering intel, gathering supplies. You're seeing tiny bits and pieces of the plan come together, but of course you have no idea what the full plan is until much later. And then the next part, a wild personal conflict appears. This is where one of the characters, usually the main character it's centered around, has some secondary objective, personal conflict that they're also dealing with. And it's risking the job, man. And then five is the job and last minute challenges. So the job happens, sometimes these challenges pop up right before, sometimes during, sometimes right at the end. The point is, the job's happening, you're finally seeing some of the plan, kind of like how it worked out together. They pull it off, they have success. That's the next part, the success. And this part also usually includes some kind of twist, where they seem like they're about to get caught, but then they don't because they already thought of that. And Ocean's 11 has a good example of this, actually.
Has a couple good examples.
So, yeah, for sure. And then the next part is the how they did it and got away, which is where they go in and fill the final last bits and pieces of the plan, where you're like, but still, how did they? And it tells you all those parts, and it tells you how they got away with it, which if you listen to the Logan Lucky episode, you know that I consider to be one of the most critical pieces of the heist movie is how they get away. So that's an important bit there. And then finally, it's the life after. What are they doing with their money? Usually the scene includes some kind of off-topic situation, like where they're just doing something totally random, not related to the money at all.
Or some sort of cathartic.
Right, and they kind of like smirk at each other, and they're like, huh! You know? Man. So, yeah, that is the Beard
Monica
heist
Beard.
Movie.
Eight-step plan to make a heist movie.
Yeah. And now, using that frame of reference there, we're going to kind of compare and contrast these two movies. We're going to just dash through it because these are both pretty old movies.
Also, they've been out for a while, so we're not going to do the whole spoiler thing because if you haven't seen it, it's your fault.
But hey, at least we chose a retro movie that is readily available for you to watch.
Yeah.
We actually wanted to do that on purpose this week, was find something on a streaming service that most people have.
So that everybody can watch it with us.
Yeah, so we can all watch it together. So, let's get into this plot, starting with the exposition / the idea.
Yes.
Now, in the 2001 Ocean's 11 movie, this starts with Danny Ocean getting released from prison.
Danny Ocean being played by George Clooney.
Oh. Oh. Anyway. So, oh, God. Sorry.
Control yourself.
A trigger word for me. I don't know. Yes. So Danny Ocean is being interviewed by a parole officer to see if he is ready to exit jail. And, you know, he's like, I'm going to reform my life and change it up. And he gets out and immediately shows us that he will not be doing that at all.
Do they ever?
No. And actually, this kind of the exposition plan thing are kind of wrapped up together in this because Danny has already been working on this plan, clearly, potentially since before he even was in prison. You don't know exactly his timeline, but you can tell he's been thinking about it for a while.
You certainly can. So with the 1960 Ocean's 11, it's a little bit different. With this one, we actually start out with a character by the name of Acebos, or Acebos, who is frantically trying to call a group of individuals, and we're slowly introduced to these individuals one by one, and we slowly find out that there is a plan afoot. So they kind of actually swap the two, where we actually get the recruitment montage before we get the idea for the heist, before we know what the idea is. And what we learn is that in the 1960 version, now this is not true for the 2001 version, in the 1960 version, all of the individuals assembled by Mr. Acebos and Danny Ocean are all members of a World War II company that have come together to use their military precision training and equipment to rob some casinos.
Yeah, definitely different from the recruitment montage in the 2001 Ocean's 11. In this one, it is understood, you can tell through, it's actually pretty cool how they make it clear that these are all career criminals without, you know, sitting there being like, they're all career criminals. Like, and it's, a lot of it is focused around this criminal jargon. That I really like. That I really like when they put that in there because it was kind of like, what? But then everyone else kind of knew what was being discussed. So, yeah, and then it has a very traditional style recruitment montage. It even, I think, has the names, like, on the screen, like, who it is. And it's your team. It's your crew.
And both of these films had a fantastic cast of characters. And cast of actors. And they all had great introductions.
Had the ensemble.
But there's one that I would like to point out in the 2001 version that every time I watch it, and when Monica saw it for the first time, we were just both a little off-put by it, and that is Matt Damon. Matt Damon's character in the 2001 Ocean's 11 is the last one introduced, and he's on a subway in Chicago, and the camera work is really weird. It's like...
Oh, it's like a, it's like that early 2000s slow motion, but it's not. It's like slow motion, stop motion.
Yeah, it's really weird.
It was the, like I, and there was,
it was like blur motion. It was so strange and bizarre, and there was no other example of that occurring in the film.
Looking back, I wonder if it was so that way we could maybe see the pickpocketing better.
But it started happening well before the pickpocketing.
Yeah.
It was very uncomfortable.
It was a weird choice. It was an early 2000s choice. Yeah. That's what I chalk it up to.
Everything in the early 2000s was a choice. We were all too busy worrying about Y2K, and then it didn't happen, and 2000 rolled around, and we were like, well, guess I'm going to wear jeans for everything now.
Whale tail.
You know what would look great? Frosted tips.
Metallics.
Oh, God, we got to get off this topic.
Did you do, were you more of a metallics type, or were you more of like see-through neon color shit type?
In 2001, I was 6 years old and fat.
Well, yeah, you know,
I definitely wore graphic t-shirts and cargo shorts.
Yeah, but every boy from age, youth to age forever wears that outfit combo for some reason.
That's fair. No,
well, let's focus back.
I was an ugly child.
Weren't we all? anyway, so bits and pieces of the plan coming together. Of course, this is a lot more clear in the 2001 version because there's actually very distinct scenes on how they're hacking into the computers. Yeah. And they're building this model, vault.
Model vault, yeah.
The model vault. And they're practicing the maneuvers and building bombs and blah, blah, blah. Like, all of this stuff happening. So you kind of, you get the bits and pieces Eckhart really well showcased in this version.
In the 1960 version, it's a little less clear. We get a lot of talk about how we're going to be. We get a lot of talk about how we're going to rob these casinos. It's going to be military precision. We got to stake the place out. We got this guy and this guy. We got an electrical engineer. But it does work out that they are they do kind of have similar plans. They are going to get an employee placed at some of the hotel or at some of the casinos, and people are going to be undercover as casino customers, and then they're going to blow the power grid and use the power. Power shut down to get into the appropriate vaults. Now, the couple of small differences. For instance, the 1961 takes place on New Year's Eve, just after midnight, whereas the 2001 Ocean's 11, the heist happens on the night of a big prize boxing match, which is when there's going to be the most money in the casinos. I think they do go, but in the 2001 version, they go a lot more into the technical aspects of the casino itself, and it's a much more high stakes, high tech heist.
They did, even in the 1960, it did have like some preparation. Some of the worst acting nonchalant I've ever seen in my life. Just their like eyes are like visibly shifting, and they're, you know, they're having discussions while standing at slot machines,
just like,
you can't see us, but me and Alex are pumping our arms like we're using a slot machine.
I've never used a slot machine in my life. I have no idea what I'm doing.
Me either. As though,
is it like pumping a well? What what's the action here?
What's the move? Yeah, so next we have the wild personal conflict. In the 2001 version, this is when Brad Pitt's character Rusty Ryan sees that Danny Ocean's ex-wife Tess is around, like she is, you know,
and is in fact at the hotel, I think, dating the owner of the casino.
Yeah, and basically Ryan goes up to Ocean and is like, you have a personal stake in this. Mm-hmm. You're working two different games here. And we know from every heist movie, you never work two different jobs.
You never try to fuck over your heist buddies.
Yeah. So
in the 1960 version, there's two minor things going on. Danny Ocean still has an estranged wife. And actually, casual alcoholism was such a thing back then, because like she talks about how, like, you know, there's always some big heist with you. And he's like, but this time I'm sober. And it's like, what? What? Jesus H. Christ. Like, good God. She's like, our marriage drowned in champagne.
Yeah.
Fuck, dude. Calm down.
She was like spitting some real words.
Oh my goodness. It was a lot.
The thing they both have in common was that the estranged wife was very much right.
Oh yeah, was totally right to leave them.
Was smart to do that.
But there were a lot of big name female actresses in this one as well.
There were a lot more women involved in.
There were a lot more women involved.
Which is kind of ironic.
The 60s one, which is not that many more, but there were more.
Right, because let it be known, neither of these movies have a particularly strong female presence.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. Anyway, so next we have the job and then last minute challenges. The jobs here, the stakes were wildly different. Like, it was a similar job, but in Ocean's 11, there were a lot of other factors. There's explosions, there's a guy who, you know, they forget to put batteries and a guy almost dies, but he's saved, and they're hiding in tubes and moving cash and making calls, the SWAT team's there. It's all, it's like craziness.
There's still an explosion in the 1960 version, but it's just one, and nothing goes wrong with it.
Right.
Whereas in the 2001 version, you have, what's his name, playing the explosives expert.
Oh my God, I got it. Don Cheadle. We were talking about this. We were talking about how you always forget, and I usually.
Well, it's because I. I don't have a reason. I didn't realize
Don Cheadle was great.
But yeah, in the 2001 version, we have Don Cheadle doing a terrible British accent.
Yeah. An unnecessary one.
Yeah, an unnecessary British accent. And he comes out of the sewer covered in shit and goes like, ah, they've bungled it up. We have to redo all the explosives and we have to go steal some sort of futuristic science fiction device from the University of California that's like a nuclear bomb, but without the actual explosion, it's an EMP blast. Yada, yada. Like, they got real technical.
They did. This movie did, and I think that's probably because, you know, in the early 2000s, if you had enough technical terms, everyone was like, sounds realistic. Yeah.
Meanwhile, in the 1960 version,
they literally had like infrared
spray with flashlights that you could only see with sunglasses.
Yeah. And
makes sense,
you know, and when they were breaking in, like, the job was literally them breaking into some big ass safes,
some very, very cartoony safes, like, we're talking
grabbing piles of money,
we're talking like you would drop this shit on Wile E. Coyote's head.
Yeah,
like
it had the casino name on the back, so you could see that they were all
on the interior of the door to the safe. It was bad.
Definitely more of a spectacle in the 2001 version.
Oh, God, yeah. Well,
They both have success in their heist, though.
Mm-hmm.
The 2001 version comes with a twist at the end where it looks like they're about to get caught, but they aren't. There's just flyers for a titty bar.
Meanwhile, weirdly enough, in the 1960 version, they just get away.
Yeah.
Scot-free.
Not really explained.
And then the 2001 version actually cuts off pretty soon after the heist. The 1960 version actually has a whole third act.
Yeah. Go ahead and that's going to fit into our life after portion, mm-hmm. which in Ocean's 11, the life after is
nil.
They get away with it. Danny Ocean did end up having to go back to prison for like a few years.
Mm-hmm.
And then, when he gets out, his buddy Rusty is waiting for him, and Tess Ocean, his estranged wife, has decided mm-hmm. to take him back for God
some reason. Honestly, I don't know why.
Chose to do that. He pulled off the heist, and then after, like, and she suddenly was just like, I love you.
To be fair, he used some clever word trickery to reveal that the casino owner who she was dating was, like, ruthless and didn't care about her. Which was evident from the start. They were both shitty men, but so she ends up back with him, and it's like, well.
Yeah, she should have just not dealt with either of them.
Are overrated.
Yeah, you know, whatever. Not the point, but yeah, so that's kind of the entirety of the life after in the 2001 version.
In the 1960 version, we get a lot more. So one of the characters actually, right before the heist, is diagnosed with a severe heart condition and only agrees to the heist because his take will send his son through college, which is pretty heartfelt.
Yeah.
You know, we dig it.
Admirable.
It's pretty admirable. But then he dies during, immediately after the heist, right in the middle of the Las Vegas Strip, of a heart attack.
Mm.
And the men get away scot-free. But then a reformed gangster, played by Cesar Romero, who we all know as the Joker in the Adam West Batman series.
That movie is so good.
Yeah, the Adam West Batman movie is amazing. Oh, it's perfect.
Oh my gosh.
We should do an episode on that sometime, because
I have to watch that movie again, dude, I'm going to rupture something.
Oh,
that
man.
Was the funniest movie I've ever
it's
seen
really
in my
good.
Life.
It's really good. It's really good. But so Cesar Romero offers to the casino owners, I'll get your money back if I get a take. And they say, sure, you know. And he manages to piece together through some really coincidental happenstance with his wife and a couple of other things that Danny Ocean and his crew were in charge of it. So he confronts Danny and is like, I know you have the money. Give it back or give me some, whatever. And what they decide to do, they hide all of the money in the dead guy's coffin.
Jeez.
For some reason.
Good.
And they only set aside the $10,000 to send the guy's kid to college. So they set that aside and give it to his widow.
At least the kid still
gets to go to college. Yeah, they give it to his widow, and then they put the $10,000 in the coffin. And they expect to collect it once the coffin is sent back to Los Angeles, and they can dig up the body and take the money back. But then in just the most random twist of fate, the mortician in Las Vegas convinces the guy's widow, Bergdorf's widow, to cremate him in the coffin. And so all the money's just gone. And they have the funeral in Las Vegas, and there's this amazing scene where they realize that the money has been burned up with the body, and they each, like dominoes, look at the next guy. Yeah. They're all sitting on the same bench
in the funeral.
And there's like nobody else in this funeral either. So they're all sitting together on one bench, like three rows back. And they look at each other one after the other until it gets to the end. And the last guy just sort of like, in what I think was supposed to be a comedic moment, like turns and bites his knuckle, like really like, ah. But, and then That's the ending credits. It's just them walking sadly past the casinos that they robbed in their funeral attire. And yeah, they're all smoking because it's the 60s and they didn't know that it would kill them. And it's just, and that's the end.
It was really
the most
funny.
Like uncathartic, uncomeuppance end.
Weird.
It was.
I'm glad heist movies don't end that way anymore.
It was very strange.
Can you imagine how unsatisfying?
Oh, it was very strange.
You go 2 hours watching this weird, weird film, and then at the end they don't even get the, you know, they don't even get the fucking money.
Oh man.
I hated that ending. Honestly, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
Let's get into these characters real quick.
Yeah.
I'm gonna blow through the ocean.
Because you're gonna
11,
know.
The 2001 characters, because you know them and you love them. That's George Clooney as Danny Ocean, and he's just so fucking beautiful.
Oh, he's what a pretty man.
So gorgeous, looking all salt and peppery. And yeah. Brad Pitt as Rusty Ryan in the best era of Brad Pitt. I'm talking Fight Club. I'm talking this movie. I'm talking Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Like, this was peak top tier Brad Pitt, like, at his most hot and powerful. Sorry, I really got into that discussion. Julia Roberts as Tess Ocean, which was, they underutilized her character a lot, but
what are you gonna do?
It's 2001, so who cares about women, am I right? And then there's Matt Damon, young baby Matt Damon, Linus Caldwell. Now, this one I could tell was Matt Damon. Older Matt Damon just looks exactly like...
He hasn't aged much.
Filling out this ensemble cast, though, you've got Bernie Mac, which is just amazing.
Anytime I see Bernie Mac, I get kind of happy.
Yeah, Elliot Gould, Casey Affleck, Scott Caan. Quinn?
Probably Chin.
Chin? Yeah, I don't know that for certain. That sounds more right. And like we said, Don Cheadle, that kind of rounds out our ensemble cast, they were really great. There was a lot of good chemistry. Like I said, incredible dialogue. Like, the chemistry between the characters was so, you know, it was quick and snappy and fun. It was really good. Like, I was actually really impressed. You don't get to see as much good writing like that, like dialogue writing today sometimes. Like, I feel like that's one of the main things in movies that end up falling flat.
Agreed.
And it was so good in this one, so.
Did you mention Andy Garcia?
Yes, Andy Garcia also, he's the
bad guy.
Is the bad guy, yes, and he played that. I really liked him in that role. And also I missed Carl Reiner.
Carl Reiner, yeah.
Yeah. So.
It's a star-studded list.
It was a star-studded, I mean, big budget film, star-studded cast, like this movie was
this
not.
This movie was designed to make money.
Yeah. And, you know, it did.
It did a great job.
Yeah, robbed everyone's wallets, if you will.
Now, we jump back 40 years to Ocean's 11, 1960. This one, also a star-studded cast, but with a different kind of star-studded cast. This one was pretty much staffed by the Rat Pack. So, for those of you who are unaware, the Rat Pack back in the 1950s and 60s was a group of famous actors and entertainers, often who did both, that were considered like the jet set. It was really started in the early 50s with Humphrey Bogart at the head. Humphrey Bogart from, of course, things like Casablanca, Maltese Falcon, things like that. The original, like, sexiest man alive actor type deal. And anybody who could pull off a fedora like that with a nose like his, definitely sexiest man alive. But so Humphrey Bogart was the original leader of it, and they called themselves the Rat Pack. But when you move into the 60s, Humphrey Bogart passed away in 57, unfortunately. When you move into the 60s, you get Frank Sinatra. And then basically the Rat Pack is formed of these really the key members. The five key members are all entertainers on the Las Vegas Strip who also act. So you've got Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Peter Lawford, and Joey Bishop. Now, the five of these folks, they were like the hot ticket items. I mean, everybody's heard those names, especially Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. And Dean Martin. I mean, all of them are something else. And these guys had all kinds of connections. Mm-hmm. There were a collection of popular female actresses and entertainers at the time, including Marilyn Monroe, who were called the Rat Pack mascots. Mm. I will say, this group, this secondary group, though, with Frank Sinatra, did have a very high opinion of themselves. Mm. After Humphrey Bogart died, they stopped referring to themselves as the Rat Pack and called themselves the Summit.
Rat Pack is better.
Yeah, the journalist kept referring to them as the Rat Pack. They also had a secondary name, the Jack Pack, because Peter Lawford was actually John F. Kennedy's brother-in-law. Mm. And so John F. Kennedy would hang out with them a lot, and that's actually how he got to know a certain Miss Monroe.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So this was a connected group of folks. Now, of course, Frank Sinatra is in George Clooney's role as Danny Ocean. And then from there, it actually completely divides. None of the characters have the same name. They're all completely different concepts, completely different kinds of criminals. But they all do a good job. You've got Dean Martin as Sam Harmon, who forms Danny Ocean's sort of second in command. He also forms the I don't know if I can do this heist. I don't think it's possible. But that lasted all of 5 minutes. He gave like this impassioned speech about, none of you are as young as you used to be. Can you run as fast? Can you jump as high? Are you smart as you used to be? This heist is impossible. And then they're like, you're a coward. And he's like, I might not be a coward, but I am stupid or not stupid. I don't know. And then it was literally really dumb. 2 minutes later, he's like, all right, I'm in.
I'm in, yeah. Whatever.
Took nothing. At least the other guy who had a change of heart was because he was dying and wanted to provide for his son.
Right.
Jesus. But yeah, so it's a star-studded cast. Can I just say, I love Peter Lawford specifically. Mm. Out of all of the Rat Pack, I love Peter Lawford just because I think he's like the definition of like ruggedly handsome. Like, he did it before Jeff Bridges. He did it before Robert Redford. Mm. For me, Peter Lawford is like token ruggedly handsome.
Ruggedly
man.
Handsome.
I mean,
guy.
He's just a pretty dude. Pretty dude.
What can you do about it? What's our big kind of overall takeaways here, you know, one versus the other? First things first, which one do you think is better?
2001.
Agreed.
2001.
100%.
I think while they were both designed to make money and they were both, I think 1960 was entirely relying on the fame of the Rat Pack and used that to get away with some lazy stuff and a low budget. Mm-hmm. But the 2011 Ocean's 11, also fantastic cast designed to rake in the cash, it put in the work. It felt like it put in the work.
Yeah, actually, I completely agree with that. It just seems like the idea was so much more, like, it just had better pacing, and again, it followed this heist movie formula, which is one of the only genres where I'd argue, like, the formula is probably something, I mean, you should deviate and do some different interesting things with your movies.
Which this one does,
and, you know, lots of heist movies can have, you can add a different element to a heist movie,
oh,
but
for sure.
I think the structure of them is really critical.
It's critical for the reveal.
It helps you pace the movie, I think, because this one, it didn't have the sort of structure that we understand in heist movies now.
Yeah, the 1960 one was a little, it felt really slow.
It did, and, you know, heist
the
movies
heist, are, the heist
supposed
proper,
to be a fast-paced type of situation.
I mean, the heist proper took, God, it felt like 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a long movie, like, it's 127 minutes.
Yeah, it was full-on 2 hours.
It was a long film.
So, in this case, the remake, it was a good idea. It should have been, like, it was a good thing.
It was a radical change in plot, radical change in concept.
Yeah, we were discussing this. We wonder almost if the name Ocean's 11 was just to, once again, try to get after that fame from the Rat Pack, or if the original was kind of a cult classic type of thing.
Because Hollywood's always, now, Hollywood has recently been doing remakes of recent films, but
yeah,
they've always been doing remakes of older films.
Yeah.
Like, that's always been a thing.
I think the main difference, though, is that, like, if you're going to do a remake of a film, you have to wait until you can do something very, like, I think you have to wait till you can do something different.
Yeah,
like,
agreed.
Till technology catches up to
agreed.
The film it's going to be, and then, yeah, like, remakes, look, we... We are not always for remakes or always against remakes.
I'm usually against.
Yeah.
Usually. This case, I'm not.
This is a good remake.
Usually, I'm against remakes.
Yeah. I really, I'm okay with them, but sometimes they happen so quickly now.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost
frustrating. The turnaround is ridiculous.
40 years of air.
Yeah, you know what I mean? 40 years of so 40 years
they,
to breathe.
Yeah, so when they remade it, they were able to remake it in mm-hmm. a really cool way with the better everything they had. Mm-hmm. You know Agreed. What I mean? So, yeah, in this case, the remake made sense. And maybe it just goes to show you need to wait longer
mm-hmm.
to fucking remake movies.
Or maybe it's saying that Hollywood should cast a wider net for things to look for. You know?
Yeah.
I would love to see them go back and recreate some of these other Rat Pack films. I think they'd be interesting. But, you know, what do I know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just a guy who talks into a microphone occasionally.
And then the final question here is, should it be remade again?
Well, they could make all the cast women. That would be a difference. Not that that's been done.
Actually, so Alex hasn't seen Ocean's 8.
I did not
8.
See it.
I did see Ocean's 8 because I was like, oh, women. You know, mm-hmm. Whatever.
Yeah,
I'm
no,
easy.
I totally wanted to. It's one of those cases of like the chintzy. I totally wanted to and I just didn't.
It's funny, though, because actually the beginning portion of Ocean's 8 is actually literally just
like almost shot for shot identical.
Yeah, to Ocean's 11, like starting out with, you know, mm-hmm. Ocean in front of the parole board and...
Mm-hmm.
Getting out and then, you know, doing a quick scam as soon as she gets out to get some, it's like, it's the very much, you know, the same structure,
mm-hmm.
but it's still different. Like they, yeah. you know, the thing they rob is different. The way they do it is different. Like in this case, it was remade, quote unquote. Like I wouldn't call it an exact remake.
So you would say, I mean, so it seems like from the 1960s
a continuation of a franchise.
To the 2001 to the 2000 and, oh God, was it 2016?
Ocean's 8? No, that was
that earlier this year?
Merely this past year.
Oh my God.
Time, it'd be moving.
So, either way, all three of them are, rather than exact remakes, they're more like riffs on the same concept.
Yeah, and Ocean's 8 was actually very good, and it was
I believe
the
it.
the only difference wasn't that they were women. Like, that was
yeah.
the difference.
No,
that
of course not,
the,
no.
The fundamental difference, like, it wasn't like they were robbing another casino.
Mm-hmm.
The quote-unquote villain characters were different. The circumstances were kind of different. It followed the... It did follow
that plot.
The heist mm-hmm. format. The only,
the
like...
The beard heist format.
The beard heist format formula. And, again, the only thing that was definitely the same was that first opening scene.
I feel like that first opening section is so iconic. That's enough to tie it together.
No, yeah, and it's cool because, you know, it's not like... And, again, it's not like this is the same Ocean, but a woman this time. It's her... It's his sister.
Oh.
Yeah.
I did not actually know that. I thought it
yes.
was I didn't realize Ocean's 8 was a... So, the 2001 Ocean's 11 did become a franchise. There's
it
an
did.
Ocean's 12 and an Ocean's 13. I actually somehow did not realize that Ocean's 8 was a continuation of the franchise.
It is, yeah. It's not a remake. In
it
a
is,
very literal
it is,
sense, it's not a remake.
Okay. That is actually a fundamental misunderstanding that I had.
Yeah. But
well,
she,
that
she,
goes to show I should have gone and seen it, shouldn't I?
Yeah, Sandra Bullock plays this. Sister.
I love Sandra Bullock.
God, that woman. Oh my gosh, and she's playing alongside Kate Blanchett.
Oh my God.
Are you kidding me?
Anne Hathaway's in there too.
Oh my God, and Kate Blanchett in the movie wears these cute suits, like these low-cut suits with no shirt under. Swoon. Anyway, yeah, Ocean's 8 is really good. I watched that. So, I don't think this movie needs to be remade in this way again.
No.
Especially considering... Now, how many different kinds of heist movies, mm-hmm. and then just like it almost seems like now for movies to be cool, like you have to have something very distinct.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like you can't just make a heist movie. Like
it's
there
be
has
a heist
to be
movie
a
in Tennessee,
a
in
heist,
the Carolinas,
a heist movie, but it's magicians. Oh, now you see me. A heist
oh,
movie,
man.
But rednecks.
Oh, it's Looking Lucky.
Yeah. So you have to, it's, you know, a heist movie, but space. So like, you have to have some sort of weird outside mm-hmm. element that's making it different enough for it to still
that's
be
fair.
Interesting.
That's,
like, that's
fair.
Just like a Hollywood trend at this point.
Mm-hmm.
To remake Ocean's 11, like that movie would bomb and
Probably.
Die and bomb. No matter whose name you put on it. I only think Ocean's 8 did as well as it did, and it did, you know, it only did, like, moderately well. Like, it wasn't a breakout or anything.
It did really well its opening weekend.
It did.
It crushed its opening weekend.
Yeah. But, like, overall, it wasn't, like, a, you know, big... It wasn't, like, a big splash or anything. I don't think it's going to make any modern classics list or anything like Ocean's 11.
Probably not.
And I think that's because, at the end of the day, it can get away because it is a continuation of a very beloved franchise.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, adds something different and has the women and stuff. But it's not... It doesn't have that extra thing that makes people, like, kind of go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, like, it doesn't have that extra Hollywood, like, you need something new.
All right. That's fair. I agree with you. Well, yeah. I need to go see Ocean's 8.
Yeah. Summary, my parting shot, go see Ocean's 8 if you haven't already, because it is different, and it's very cool and very good.
I did see the all-female Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
I didn't like it, but I saw it.
I didn't like it either, and I don't really like Ghostbusters anyway.
Mm.
Like, I didn't like the all-male version either. Ridiculous. I don't know what it is. That concept is...
It's just Ghostbusters. You don't have to call it the all-male Ghostbusters.
Anyway. yeah. I didn't like Ghostbusters. And surprise, surprise, I didn't like the new one either. So...
I liked Chris Hemsworth. I thought he was funny.
Oh, yeah. I like to look at Chris Hemsworth.
Stop objectifying him.
I will never. I will never as long as I live.
Oh, man.
What is he going to do? Stop me?
Probably not.
Unlikely.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So your parting shot is go see Ocean's 8?
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's one case where, like, and actually they do take the opportunity to explain why she chose for it to be an all-woman crew in the movie.
Oh, good.
And it was a really good explanation. I don't know if I want to spoil you.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, we're going to do a quick spoiler alert if you care that much about this, but who does? The reason she wants it to be all women, and I love that they added this because they could have easily have not, was she was like, somebody was like, why all women? And she was like, because everyone overlooks a woman.
Oh, that's good. That is good. That's a good line.
It was nuts. It was so good. Yeah. So right. They not only do it, but they explain it, and the explanation is just like, ah!
Pretty fucking solid.
Yes!
Pretty fucking solid.
Take them out, sis. What about you? Do you have a parting shot?
You know, I don't know that I actually do. Normally, I've got something going on, but I don't really have a parting shot per se.
I think our piece was...
Oh, no, you have a different parting shot that you also wanted to mention, because Monica has actually watched a TV show.
Everyone, she doesn't really like TV shows. I watched a TV show, yeah, which is very rare for me. And not only did I watch it, I binge-watched 5 episodes, and I'm really invested, and...
This is big news for me, because I've never heard her this excited funny. About TV.
And I actually...
Even The Flash.
Yeah, not even The Flash. And actually, as I'm thinking about it, I almost wonder if I mentioned this in another episode, like, in a very hateful way.
We did mention it, I think, in another episode.
I've talked about it before. So I'm talking about Titans... Which, when the live-action TV series that's on DC, on the new streaming service that DC has, it's called DC Universe, it's $7.99 a month, which, you know, I do not want to have another streaming service, but if you really want to watch the show, it is only $7.99 a month. And also...
You can knock it out in under a month.
Well, that's the thing, you still have to wait for weekly releases, which is bullshit. There's only 5 episodes out right now. I know, I hate it. But it's pretty cool because it also has, like, tons of DC movies, like really old Superman movies, really old Batman movies, a lot of the animated movies, including Under the Red Hood, which is the best Batman animated movie. Do not at me.
Yeah, you're right.
And you can also read a bunch of comics on there if you have the service. So, yeah. Just had a quick talk about that because I, you know, might as well give a quick information before you have to go look into it. But the show, Titans, the live-action version of the Teen Titans TV show from back in 2003, it looked really bad. The first pictures were very bad, and everyone was like, honey,
oh, God,
and
that first trailer, which seemed, like, so
cringe.
Edgy, and Robin's like, fuck Batman.
Yes, it was fuck so, Batman. It looked so edgelordy and bad. Like, I saw the trailer, and I was like, this looks terrible. And the other day... what made me decide to just watch it, you know, just to give it a shot, was because somebody posted a gift set from the newest episode, and it was the very new episode, and it was Jason Todd, and I was like, well, I'm a slave to my my love for Jason Todd.
She knows what she likes.
So I was like, yeah, I'm gonna go watch it real quick just so I can, you know, I want to see Jason Todd, what can I say, in live action. And I saw the first episode was an hour, and I was like, I cannot do this. And then I got to the end, and I was like, next episode. And I watched all of them in one night, and it is cheesy at times, admittedly.
I don't think I've seen a superhero TV show that isn't at times.
Yeah, the CGI is bad. Whatever. Some of the character designs, a little iffy. Actually, I will say Anna Diop as Starfire, like, at first I really hated
her. She was honestly the one I had the least problem with.
Yeah, well, when I first saw the picture, I was like, honey, what is going on there? But she is ethereal, and she is playing the hell out of her. It is, like, actually, and this goes for all the characters, what really got me into it was how well these characters are portrayed.
Hmm.
I was really pleasantly surprised at the characterization. I really like all of them.
Okay.
And they kind of twist up the ages a little bit. So in the original cartoon series and in most iterations of the comics, it's basically, you know, Robin is, they're all around the same age, they're all teenagers, and Robin is the
leader.
Yeah, the leader, maybe not necessarily oldest or whatever, but they're all pretty close in age and stuff. Mm-hmm. But in this one, actually, Robin is an adult. He's fully grown. He's already left Gotham separately on his own, like on his own accord.
Mm-hmm.
And then Raven is really young. She's 14. She's like 14.
Wow.
And her actress is actually 14 as well.
Yes. I love age-appropriate casting.
Yeah, they age-appropriately cast it, and it really is effective. So in this case, it's cool because with Raven, she is not the character she was in the TV show or in the comics at all, who's very stoic and has control over her powers and stuff. Like in this one, she's very young, and she doesn't know what's going on, and she's just afraid of herself. And okay. That's their character interaction is really interesting with him as the older person and her as the child.
Mm-hmm.
And then Starfire and Beast Boy, their ages are kind of like, they're both older as well. So it's just like, it's really, they kind of twist the ages a little bit, and it creates different character dynamics, and it's really good.
So I've got a question.
Yes.
Because Cyborg was in Justice League. Is Cyborg
not in Titans? He's not. I don't think
I'm going to be honest with you. That's a little upsetting because Cyborg has always been my favorite.
Extremely upsetting.
I can't believe they used him in Justice League.
That's extremely Cyborg's my upsetting. Fave. Yeah, I actually 100% agree with that. I could use a booyah now and again. What can I? Everybody who watched the TV show.
They got it.
Yeah, they know.
Well, tell you what you actually brought up something that I would like to talk about as my parting shot. Because this
Please.
Is, you know what really grinds my gears?
Please tell me.
So, we've got a problem, folks, and that problem is there is a market that we are all very, very attached to that is going to be collapsing very, very soon, and I'm almost certain of this, and that is the streaming service market.
Oh, fuck, dude. I have,
because
like, so many
everybody
services.
Has decided to make their own streaming service. We had Netflix the longest time, then Redbox tried and failed. Mm-hmm. Then we get Hulu, then we get HBO Go, and then we get Disney. Now wants to make their own, and DC has their own, and then we have Verve, which has access to Crunchyroll and things like that. And then Amazon Prime Video comes out, and then now everyone seems to want to make their own. The BBC wants to have their own for things like Doctor Who and stuff like that. Even YouTube channels are moving mm-hmm. to it. College Humor, which is one of my favorite sketch comedy groups in the universe, mm-hmm. they've made their own streaming service called Dropout. Like, there's gonna come a point where getting all of the shows you want is going to cost the same as cable.
Right.
People embraced Netflix, embraced Hulu, hell, even embraced HBO mm-hmm. because they provided an alternative to cable services and then started making their own original content, which is great. But now everybody wants in on their cut
Eventually,
of the market, and it's going to collapse the market. And then all these people are going to say, well, it wasn't a business model that was meant to last because look what happened. And Netflix and Hulu are going to be sitting there like, no, it was working just fine
until
when
you guys
let us.
All done here. And it's really frustrating, too, because, again, like I said, You have to get the streaming service, right? Mm-hmm. And you get a week free trial, so I was just going to watch all of the season for the week
but they
free
haven't. Trial. But they don't.
They're releasing. They're still doing a weekly release schedule.
That's stupid. I don't like that at all. That's really frustrating. The only time I would accept that from Netflix or Hulu is when Netflix did The Break with Michelle Wolf, because that was a topical news show.
Right. But, like, it would make me more angry. It would make me more angry if it didn't come with a lot of other things. The streaming service didn't come with a lot mm-hmm. of other features.
Yeah, like, the comics and stuff, that actually kind of brings up an interesting idea of diversifying what your streaming service
is. Yeah, and it has, like, and they do, like, online communities, and they have, like, a literal Wikipedia, basically a superhero Wikipedia, which I am...
Oh, I would spend hours on that.
I am a monster nerd. I know it maybe is already clear, but I want to reiterate, I am a monster nerd.
I can't tell you how much time I spent on the Lord of the Rings wiki.
Yeah, you can, like, go to a character and it'll show you, like, what all their runs and what they did in their comic runs. It's pretty cool, actually.
Okay,
good if you want to find specific comic runs for your favorite characters. There's some value added to it, but there's so many, and I feel like eventually we're going to have so many of those that it's going to get to the point where some service comes out that says, here, we'll take all of your streaming service accounts and just put it on one account so you can see every single thing mm-hmm. you can watch through your streaming services, and then you just have cable again.
Yep.
Then it's the same thing.
So, yeah, that's my parting shot, which we're both upset about.
Exhausting.
Is capitalism ruins everything.
Yeah, and the worst part is my dumbass is still going to get Disney Plus because I want to watch these awesome series they're talking about. They're talking about doing a Loki solo series, which has been confirmed by Tom Hiddleston, which is just bananas. And they're also doing a Winter Soldier Falcon buddy series.
And like any Star Wars stuff that's going to be on there, I want to see.
Yeah, they're going to have a Rogue One series. They're going to do Mandalorian.
The Jango and Boba Fett.
Yes. So, like, it's going to have a lot of good stuff on that one, too. It's just frustrating because, like, now you have to have literally every streaming service if you want to watch all the things.
Hey, Monica. Monica, want to hear a joke?
What?
What do you call it when Quentin Tarantino directs a Star Wars film about a bounty hunter? Django Unchained.
I think on that note.
I think is that our it's time to end?
I'm ready. All right, I'm ready to wrap this up. Thank you for listening. I'm sorry we spent the last 10 minutes. Just ranting.
Ripping into fucking everything.
Ranting really hard about capitalism. What can you do? Okay. Really quick, we're going to blast through this part. Our social media, we are at Shot for Shotcast on Instagram. We are at Shot for Shotcast on Facebook. We are at www.shotforshotcast.com. You can see us at Shot for Shotcast on Podbean. That's all of the social media. We also have our personal accounts. Alex, yours?
I am at Large Lebowski on Twitter, at The Large Lebowski on Instagram. And Monica?
I am Afroelectric on Instagram. As always, thank you guys so much. We got some more reviews recently, which is really nice. Once again, it's amazing if you leave just a 5-star review. We appreciate that so much. But if you have a little bit of extra time on your hands and you really, really, really want to help us out, you could also leave a little comment review. It helps us out with the... It just helps us out with kind of getting higher on
charts. Making sure that we appear more when people are what movie podcast should I watch?
Yeah, so we would really appreciate it. And if you need a prompt, your prompt is, what is your favorite Stan Lee cameo?
Very good.
Yeah, it's the same question we asked. Or your favorite heist movie. One of those two questions, answer that in a review along with 5 stars. Alex, are you ready to finish this off?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for tuning in to another episode of Shot for Shotcast. Booyah!